to be free by the Kinks. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Monday, April 5th, 2010, Julian Assange released a shocking video at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. The now infamous tape, which WikiLeaks titled Collateral Murder, was shot in 2007 from a U.S. military Apache helicopter flying over New Baghdad, Iraq. It shows U.S. forces killing 12 people, including two Reuters employees, Saeed Shema, 40 years old, and Namir Nur Eldin. He was an up-and-coming Reuters videographer. The video comes from the Apache helicopter.
Let me know when you get it. Watch you. Light them all up.
202 traffic, 260.
Come on, fire.
Hey, Roger.
Keep shooting. Keep shooting.
Bushmaster, two things. We need to move time now.
All right, we just engaged all eight individuals.
Reuters driver Saeed Shema survived the initial attack. He's seen trying to crawl away as the U.S. Apache helicopter flies overhead. U.S. forces then open fire again when they see a van pulling up to evacuate the wounded Shema.
Bodies.
Where's that van at?
Right down there by the body.
Okay, yeah.
Bushmaster, Crazy Horse, we have individuals going to the scene. Looks like possibly picking up bodies and weapons.
Let me engage.
Hey, we need to stop that. We can get down there.
Hey, shoot.
You see my location?
Break. Crazy Horse 1-8, request permission to engage.
Picking up the wounded. Yeah, we're trying to get permission to engage. Come on, let us shoot.
A Bushmaster, Crazy Horse 1-8.
We're taking him.
Bushmaster, Crazy Horse 1-8.
This is Bushmaster 7, go ahead.
Roger, we have a black SUV, or a bongo truck, picking up the box. Request permission to engage.
Bushmaster 7, roger. This is Bushmaster 7, roger, engage.
1-8, engage. Clear.
Come on.
Clear. Clear.
We're engaged.
Coming around, clear.
Roger. Trying to,
Clear.
Roger, I lost him in the
dust. I got him. Should have a van in the middle of the road with about 12 to 15 bodies.
Oh yeah, look at that, right through the windshield.
That clip from the collateral murder video released by WikiLeaks in April 2010. The van that had come to help the wounded was a father taking his two children to school. They were critically wounded in the attack as well. The video's release was followed by the publication of hundreds of thousands of digital records from the U.S. military, dubbed the Iraq War Logs and the Afghan War Diary. In November 2022, five major newspapers that worked with WikiLeaks, the New York Times, The Guardian, Le Monde, El País, and Der Spiegel, released a joint letter calling for an end to Julian Assange's prosecution. They write, quote, "Obtaining and disclosing sensitive information when necessary in the public interest is a core part of the daily work of journalists. If that work is criminalized, our public discourse and our democracies are made significantly weaker," unquote. For more, we stay in London with Alan Rusbridger. He was the editor-in-chief of The Guardian for 20 years. He's now the editor of Prospect magazine. He recently wrote a piece that was headlined, "Enough is Enough. It's Time to Set Julian Assange Free." Alan, welcome back to Democracy Now! That video that we just saw, Reuters had attempted to get the video released because it showed the death of their two employees, Namir Nur Eldin and Saeed Shema, and they couldn't get it released. It was only when WikiLeaks released it that they were able to see the evidence of what happened, not to mention of the Iraqis on the ground. Can you talk about why you're getting involved with this case, why you think it's so significant?
Well, that video and the battle to have it released is at the heart of what WikiLeaks was doing. You have to remember that initially the US government lied about what happened there, in addition to refusing Reuters access to the video for 3 years. They first of all claimed that the helicopter had come under attack from insurgents. And their second line of defense was that all the people who were killed were in fact terrorists or insurgents. Neither of those was true. And that is why you need national security reporting and the ability to sometimes delve into matters that are considered secret by governments. And that's why I'm so concerned about the attempt to use this really heavy legislation, the Espionage Act, which has no defense, to prosecute Julian.
Can you talk about the argument that we hear and the corporate media, certainly in the United States, repeated over and over, that he's not like newspapers like yours? You were the editor of The Guardian or The New York Times, though he worked with all of you, because he released names, he endangered people. Can you respond to that?
I certainly can. He wasn't the first person to do that. There was another website that released material, and it's now become apparent that he actually went to some attempts, certainly to tip the U.S. government off, before he felt the necessity to release them. Now, I mean, we had disagreements about that at the time. We weren't in touch, and I don't think the five newspapers knew of his attempts to alert the authorities. But I think it's really a smokescreen for the way that, certainly since the Edward Snowden revelations, which I was also involved in, the US government, the Australian government, the UK government have all tried to tighten up the laws and their punitive behavior towards journalists to try and create a situation where no one will ever do that kind of reporting again. And that video that you kicked this interview off with is one illustration of why that shouldn't be allowed to happen.
You write, Alan Rusbridger, why should we care? There's no shortage of people who don't much. They don't like Julian Assange. It has to be conceded he has a unique ability to lose friends and alienate people. Many in the media don't believe he's a proper journalist and therefore won't lift a finger to defend him. It's not like you're a friend of his, Alan.
No, we've had well-publicized fallings out. But I think in the current situation, you have to look beyond the person. Assange has famously fallen out with many people who have tried to work with him. But that's not the point. The point is what is happening in the legal sphere. I mean, the way I like to think about it is to reverse the situation. Imagine that you had an American journalist in London who had been working on, say, I don't know, the Indian nuclear program. We know there is one, but it's secret. And suppose they publish something. Imagine the Indian government saying to the British government, we need to extradite this American journalist to put them in jail in India for breaking our official secrets laws. Can you imagine the American government would allow that to happen? Can you imagine that extradition going ahead? So as Jen Robinson was just saying, it's all very well for people who think of themselves as proper journalists to sit this one out. But the precedent that is going to be set by this case, if he is extradited, should worry everybody.
Do you think it's valid to make a comparison, for example, with Evan Gershkovich, the Wall Street Journal reporter, who's been imprisoned by Putin in Russia? They said he was trying to get military secrets, something a lot of journalists do try to do. What about the U.S. trying to extradite and imprison Julian Assange, if found guilty, for 175 years? What did he do? Try to release military secrets, he actually did, of the U.S. government.
Well, Russia's an entirely different kind of state, so I wouldn't want to make a direct comparison. But I think there is the problem about official secrecy and the nature of the ability that Edward Snowden revealed of now complete control and surveillance and monitoring of populations. And Somebody has to keep these people accountable. They have the power of life and death over us. They have the power of captivity and freedom. And anyone who's read George Orwell can see that the state that has that power needs to be monitored. And I'm afraid what the governments are now trying to do is to frighten journalists off. In Britain, you can now go to jail for 14 years as an editor to do what I did with Edward Snowden. And they've explicitly refused to allow any editor the right to a defense. So you can't even explain why you thought this might have been in the public interest. So the danger is that people like Assange, like Chelsea Manning, like the New York Times, are going to be so discouraged from doing what they should be doing that this kind of activity will be completely blind to us in future.
Very quickly, Alan Rusbridger, if you can explain what exactly you did related to Edward Snowden and that hard drive. And let's remember that it was WikiLeaks that helped Ed Snowden when the authorities were moving in on him in Hong Kong to get out of Hong Kong. He ultimately ended up in Russia and couldn't leave the airport because the U.S. pulled his passport. But it was WikiLeaks and Julian Assange who helped him get out. And talk about what you did in the basement of The Guardian.
The British government eventually came to us and said, if you don't agree to stop publishing, we will stop you. And so it was plain there. They were either going to injunct us or they were going to send the police in. So I told them that we would go on reporting from New York because the First Amendment is a very powerful instrument to defend the press, which is what we did. And the quid pro quo was that we would destroy the computers that we had been using in London. I think that was just a piece of theater. But it reminds us about why the First Amendment is so important and why we mustn't allow people to chip away at these protections that journalists have.
I want to end with a Meet the Press interview with Joe Biden, then vice president, in 2010. ABC host David Gregory questioned Biden about Assange.
Should the United States do something to stop Mr. Assange?
We're looking at that right now. The Justice Department is taking a look at that, and I'm not going to comment on that process.
Do you think he's a criminal?
If he conspired to get these classified documents with a member of the U.S. military, that's fundamentally different than if somebody drops on your lap, here, David, you're a press person. Here is classified material.
Mitch McConnell says he's a high-tech terrorist. Others say this is akin to the Pentagon Papers. Where do you come down?
I would argue that it's closer to being a high-tech terrorist.
He would argue that it is closest, that Julian Assange is being a high-tech terrorist. Alan Rusbridger, your final comment on what you're calling for now.
I remember a time when Julian Assange was first working in Kenya, releasing documents, when even Hillary Clinton was making speeches about how this was the new form of Savazat publishing and was in favor of dissidents using the internet to release material. That's all changed now. But I think the world should wake up as to what the nature of the threat is going to be to mainstream journalism if this extradition is successful.
Alan Rusbridger was the editor-in-chief of The Guardian for more than 20 years, now the editor of Prospect magazine. We'll link to his piece headlined, Enough is Enough, It's Time to Set Julian Assange Free. When we come back, Haitian asylum seekers go to court over federal agents abusing them at the U.S.-Mexico border. Stay with us. Creole Bell by the legendary blues singer and guitarist Mississippi John Hurt. Earlier this week, a fire destroyed the Mississippi John Hurt Museum in his hometown of Avalon, Mississippi, just hours after it received landmark status. The museum was built inside of John Hurt's home, a humble three-room shack with a tin roof that was about 200 years old. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal court in Washington, D.C. heard arguments Thursday in a lawsuit accusing the Biden administration of racial discrimination and rights violations of Haitian asylum seekers. The suit was brought by the Haitian Bridge Alliance and other immigrant rights groups in 2021 on behalf of 11 Haitian asylum seekers who described being abused by U.S. border agents as more than 15,000 people, mostly Haitian, were forced to stay in a makeshift border encampment on the banks of the Rio Grande near the Acuña del Rio International Bridge in Texas. Photographs and video footage from 2021 showed Border Patrol agents on horseback chasing, grabbing, whipping Haitian asylum seekers in Del Rio and sparked widespread condemnation. One border agent was heard screaming obscenities at asylum seekers there in Texas, including children.
Hey, you use your women? This is why your country...
After the attack in Del Rio, Texas, President Biden condemned the, quote, horrible treatment of the Haitian migrants and promised a swift investigation.
It's outrageous. I promise you those people will pay. They will be an investigation underway now, and there will be consequences.
While the investigation was underway, Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas said horse border patrols were suspended.
The investigation into what occurred has not yet concluded. We know that those images painfully conjured up the worst elements of our nation's ongoing battle against systemic racism.
That was Mayorkas in 2021. During a news conference last year, journalist April Ryan questioned Mayorkas about the attack by Border Patrol agents that sparked national outcry.
The southern border is not just Mexicans. It is Haitians. It's Africans, as we've seen, particularly with that issue with the Haitians being whipped with the reins or the horses. But what is there?
Well, let me just correct you right there, because actually the investigation concluded that the whipping did not occur.
I'm sorry. I saw it differently. They were whipped with something from the horse.
One of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit is Miraj Joseph, who was photographed as a Border Patrol agent on horseback, lashed him with split reins, grabbed his neck, and gripped Joseph by the shirt collar. After the assault, Joseph and his family were detained, then deported to Haiti. For more, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Gerline Joseph, co-founder and executive director of Haitian Bridge Alliance, an immigrant advocacy group that provides humanitarian assistance to Haitians and other Black immigrants from the Caribbean and Africa. Gerline, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain why you're in Washington, D.C., what happened to Miraj Joseph and his family members?
Thank you, and good morning, Amy. We are currently in D.C. because yesterday we were in court to be able to highlight the realities of what we just saw on the screen. That did happen. It happened, and we have the proof. Everybody saw it. So yesterday we came to court to be able to address those issues because the U.S. government reached out asking for dismissal of our case. So we continue to be able to fight to make sure that justice is rendered, to make sure that people do not forget the realities of what happened in Del Rio in 2021. We filed our lawsuit in December of 2021. It wasn't until yesterday we were able to have our first hearing for the judge to let us know if they will decide to continue with the case. And what was very critical as well is that we had four of the plaintiffs present in the courtroom to show that they are here. It wasn't just something that happened. They are people, and we want to make sure that continues to be the case. So we had Miraj Joseph, whom everybody saw the pictures, the videos of what he was subjected to in addition to three other plaintiffs who were able to be there and share their stories with us, but really to humanize, to put human faces in how the anti-Black racism in our immigration system is continued to be a space that we have to fight.
And then explain what happened to Joseph's family and he himself. I mean, not only what happened right there on the border, but the detention and the ultimate deportation to Haiti, and what you're calling for in the lawsuit.
Amy, one of the hardest things that we had to deal with is the fact that the U.S. government tried to erase the very fact that the people existed by expulsion and deportation. And one thing that yesterday the people were recounting when we were talking to them is the fact that they were held, caged for over 2 weeks without access to any hygiene and then deported. One of them shared with us yesterday that when he finally was chained and deported, when he arrived in Haiti, they gave him a piece of bread. And when he tasted the bread, it tasted sour. And it wasn't until later he realized that the taste that was in his mouth did come from the bread, but from the fact that he was held without access to brushing his teeth for so long. So that's why we continue to fight, and we want to make sure we hold the administration accountable. We hold the system accountable for the inhuman treatment of people seeking protection and safety. And Mirard and the 11 other plaintiffs are representation of the 15,000 Haitians and other people who were under the bridge in the inhumane injustice and mistreatment that they received in the abuse and the violence of deportation and expulsion.
Just days after the U.S. Border Patrol agents on horseback were filmed chasing and grabbing the Haitian asylum seekers in Del Rio, Texas, the U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti resigned in protest over the Biden administration's mass deportation of Haitian asylum seekers. In a letter, the longtime diplomat Daniel Foote wrote, quote, "I will not be associated with the United States' inhumane, counterproductive decision to deport thousands of Haitian refugees." Gerline Joseph, can you talk about the significance of this U.S. official resigning? Are you bringing this into your case? And what's happened to all the other people we see in the photographs, in addition to Mirard Joseph and his family?
Yeah, the resignation of Ambassador Foote was also a critical indication of human morality, right? For somebody to say, "I will not stand by and continue to agree to this type of inhuman treatment." So we applaud and continue to say thank you to Ambassador Foote for standing up on behalf of what is right, on behalf of human dignity. Because I will be honest with you, history will definitely judge harshly the impact of what happened. And we understand that many laws need to be changed. We understand that this is a critical junction in our country here in the United States as we make sure they uphold the human rights and understanding seeking asylum is a human right, and also understanding many of the reason why people are fleeing countries like Haiti. U.S. foreign policies are major factors of what's happening. Currently dealing with gang violence, currently dealing with political turmoils, currently seeing how there is this big movement to send Kenyan police force into Haiti, but at the same time, understanding that the United States just put a warning on the Bahamas and Jamaica, with countries we just learned that will also be a part of this special envoy, special military police force to Haiti, making sure that we hold folks accountable and let them know we are watching and the world is watching, that justice must prevail.
In your lawsuit, are you asking that deported Haitians be allowed back into the United States to fight fairly their immigration cases?
Yes, there are a few things we are asking for. We'll be able to share more as the case continues. But one of the things we are asking is accountability, justice for those people to be able to get a fair access to asylum, fair access to protection as they continue to barely survive, because the conditions in Haiti continues to be extremely difficult. And the deportation and expulsions of those people were found to be unacceptable. So we will continue to fight, and we are grateful that the judge listened to our request to continue the case. And even though the government said that our case had no basis, and what the world saw is that what we witnessed, but we will continue to push forward and make sure that accountability is served. But also, we have systematic change in the way that we receive people in the United States, in making sure that we have a fair, just immigration system where people can continue to seek asylum and seeking protection.
I wanted to ask you about President Biden facing more backlash over his handling of the humanitarian crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border. Following reports, the White House is considering executive action to deny the right to request asylum for migrants who enter through non-official ports of entry. The authority was previously invoked by the Trump administration. In response, the Congressional Progressive Caucus chair, Pramila Jayapal, said, quote, "Cruel enforcement-only policies have been tried for 30 years and simply do not work. Democrats cannot continue to take pages out of Donald Trump and Stephen Miller's playbook. We need to lead with dignity and humanity," Jayapal said. Your response, Gerlene?
We are 100% in line with Congresswoman Jayapal, and we continue to make sure that is at the center of everything that we do. And we call on President Biden that he stand to the ideal and the values that he promised to save the soul of America. Those policies and executive orders that are being contemplated are the opposite of saving the soul of America. And we will say again, if they move forward with those only deterrence policies that, as we all mentioned and have seen, are reflecting of former President Trump and his administration and Stephen Miller, those will become the legacy of President Biden. And as we said before, history will really judge harshly those outcomes. So again, we call on President Biden to center any decisions at the U.S.-Mexico border into dignity, compassion, fairness, and human lives. So we continue to push back on those ideas. We'll continue to coordinate and collaborate and say thank you to those who are standing on the right side of history. And we are asking President Biden to do the right thing and make sure that we follow policies that will save lives. Amy, this past week we had a woman
from Jamaica. We're going to leave it there, Gerlene Joseph, but continue to cover this issue, of course, Executive Director of the Haitian Bridge Alliance. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Ooh, Open Mic on CJSF 90.1 is where you can listen to fresh new releases from any genre, any day of the week. Visit cjsf.ca for the latest Open Mic schedule.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.